Welcome back to Spotify, a product story. I'm your host, Gustav Söderström. I'm Spotify's co-president, which means I head up product, engineering, data, and design at Spotify. In season one, over the course of 10 episodes, we brought you never-before-heard stories about Spotify's biggest product launches, business deals, and pivots, and the key product strategy lessons we took from them over the years. And now, after seeing all of your comments, emails, and posts formerly known as tweets, we're back. But instead of waiting until we have a full season's worth of stories, we're going to release episodes whenever we have new lessons to share. So make sure you're following us so that you don't miss an episode. Okay? You ready? Let's go. Ever since Spotify was founded in 2006, our users have told us about their nostalgia for radio. And I get it. It's so simple, right? Just a single dial. People are sentimental and often even a little bit romantic about their memories of scanning the dial. Tuning into that same familiar voice going out over the airwaves.
The station that rocks.
But if you peel away all that nostalgia and actually think about it from a product standpoint, it actually really sucks. You always come in the middle of the song. It's not personalized to you, and you can't skip a track you don't like. And the host just says the same thing over and over again every 5 minutes.
And now here's the traffic.
Because they never know when someone joins and starts listening. And there isn't even an option to remove the ads.
Terms and conditions apply.
Terms and conditions apply.
Terms and conditions apply.
But how did it get this way? Let's take a minute and nerd out about the history of radio. While people think that commercial DJ-driven radio is a deliberate and thoughtful music format, the truth is that its popularization is actually the rather accidental outcome of trying to cut costs and maximize revenue. By the golden age of radio, the medium was financed by ad breaks, but the talk content that audiences loved, in the form of radio dramas and variety shows, was expensive to produce and had high upfront costs. You had to pay the hosts and talent, build out sound stages, and create original shows. This is actually how radio networks first emerged, to take those costs and amortize them over more listeners than any individual station could. It wasn't long before TV came after radio's audience, and many radio stations had to scale back to doing what only radio could do best, playing music. Meanwhile, recorded music's quality had become good enough to broadcast. And as a result, this became the cheaper way to fill airtime between ad breaks. To understand why this was such a great deal for the industry, you need to understand the music rights landscape. While streaming services like Spotify today pay royalties to the labels and artists every time a song plays, back then, the main revenue source for labels was selling physical records. They saw their songs being played on radio as promotion for those records, and actually started sending the music to the radio channels for free. With barely any royalty costs and no live musicians to pay anymore, the radio industry had found an almost infinite source of practically free, extremely repeatable content to put ads against. Oh, and by the way, radio stations still don't pay recording artists royalties. When you hear a song on the radio, only the songwriters and music publishers get any money. So rather than a deliberate music format constructed for maximum consumer value, music on the radio was really a means to an end, and rather accidental. Like with so many other things we're nostalgic about, it's more that we got used to the radio format and accepted it, in spite of its flaws, rather than because it was so great. This doesn't mean that radio was all bad. There was still convenience and simplicity there. And we could see that there was a user problem that radio solved that Spotify didn't. Because when surveying our users, we could see that they still tended to go to their non-personalized ad-filled car radio, even when they had Spotify hooked up to their car speakers, with millions of tracks at their fingertips. To give our users what they wanted, we needed to pick apart the things that were actually good about radio, capture them, and remove the rest. Our hunch was that this, millions of tracks at your fingertips, with no one to guide you and give you context, was actually the problem. But for a long time, in spite of many attempts, it seemed like an impossible riddle to solve. Today's episode is about our answer to that riddle, and about the vision, technology, very real human personality, and years of experimentation that all contributed to making a radio DJ just for you. Meet AI DJ.
Hey, what's going on? It's really great to be here with you. I'm Xavier. My friends call me X. And from this moment on, I'm going to be your own personal AI DJ on Spotify. Yeah, I'm an AI, but listen, I don't set timers. I don't switch on your lights. I'm all about music, your music.
If you listened to last season, you know that at Spotify, the dream has always been to create the perfect listening session. Imagine one big play button that will always play exactly what you want to hear in that moment. Even, or actually especially, when you don't know what you feel like listening to. Algotorial, which we covered in episode 4, was a huge leap in that direction for us. It combined the sophistication of a handpicked selection of songs informed by experts with a personalization that could only be provided at scale by an algorithm. We thought Algotorial was the closest we could get to giving everyone on Spotify their very own personal DJ. Until generative AI came along.
With the DJ, we decided this is the time to build it, to build that exact North Star to make the metaphor a reality.
Ziad Soltan is Spotify's VP of personalization. Back when Ziad started at Spotify in 2019, we were determined to build one feature that managed to capture and improve upon everything people love about radio.
There were great things about the radio, of course. And we are an audio company, so when we think about what we want to bring to our listeners and users around the world, music is one thing, but talk is also another with podcasts and audiobooks, right? So we are trying to blend those things because when put together, it's extremely valuable.
For example, music and talk, a unique format that let podcasters create playlists featuring a combination of music and spoken word. At the same time, we were also experimenting with voice interactivity. The idea was that since most of the time when people are listening to radio, they're in the car, they'd need voice commands to navigate the music selection.
And at the time, all the team members were trying out that product, and we were switching back and forth between a music and a podcast and trying to figure out what is the right mode to interact with it. And you could see there was something promising there, but the path to market was not super clear, and we were trying to figure out what are the challenges.
And in the process, we discovered something really valuable. There are two different types of listening. Listening to music could be described as mind busy. Basically, your mind can be busy thinking about something else, like studying, while music is playing in the background. We call the other type of listening mind-free listening. When you're running, for example, and your mind is free to pay attention to what you're listening to, like a podcast or a book. Combining these two types of listening in the same session, say with the song followed by a 45-minute podcast episode, followed by another song, just didn't work the way we thought it would. People didn't like being pulled back and forth between paying attention versus zoning out. They didn't have the patience to sit through an entire song if they were actively listening to the talk content, and vice versa. And trying to force it, along with the added element of voice interactivity, was making the DJ prototype weaker.
So then I used the product developer's best tool, which is squinting. And I said,
there's a lot of squinting at Spotify.
A lot of squinting in product development and in scoping. And so we tried this product for ourselves internally. And it just felt like if you focus on the music and then you did squint, we had a good product. So we ended up looking at all of the moving pieces and saying that if you look at it in just the right way and you design just the right mandate for it, you actually have an amazing product.
In retrospect, it was obvious. Listening to a talk show and listening to a music session are two very different types of sessions. And you shouldn't try to mix the two into one. If the user wants a talk show, they will start a podcast. If they want a music session, they will start a playlist. We had confused the technical format, music and talk, with the use case, which is music or talk. The team realized this and decided that this was a mind-free music session. meaning that the only talk you should hear should be minimal and in service of the music.
The squinting-based approach of scoping told us that focusing on music just might work. And specifically, we scoped it to say, if we focus on music and if we don't need voice interactions, we have a product that we think can make it to market pretty quickly and in a very compelling way. That was one of the big turning points.
Which is the basis of our first product strategy lesson. Great products are not a sum of their parts. They're an average of their parts. One of the most common product mistakes is to try to create products that try to do too much and instead end up doing nothing particularly well. A common instinct when it comes to product and feature development is strength in numbers, meaning that even if I'm not entirely sure about this one thing or feature being great, if I just add more of them, surely the sum of all the half-good things should still add up to a single great thing, right? Wrong. Product development is not a sum, meaning lots of okay things add up to something great. It's an average, meaning that adding lots of okay things still just averages out to okay, never great. So the job is actually to keep the average high by never adding just okay features. And guess what? Another way to bring up the average is to remove just okay features. Building a good product or feature is often like peeling an onion. You keep removing layer after layer, feature after feature, and yes, you may cry as you do so, until you only have the core left. So Ziad and his team kept peeling away.
If you zero in on it and the user has chosen they want music, now you have scoped down the problem in a way that lets you really innovate much more. You have freed yourself of the constraint that it has to work with a one-hour podcast. And then the next thing is you have freed yourself of the constraint that you have to be able to, you know, skip talk if you're not in the mood for it. So you have suddenly brought back the problem to a music recommendation problem with very light interactions. And what we found was that actually created the right framing for the team to do some magic and build an AI DJ.
Back in episode one, we said that every great product needs to pull off a magic trick. We had just figured out our next big magic trick. To satisfy people's radio nostalgia, we needed to make an AI DJ that was so good it could potentially give every single one of our 500 million users the illusion that Spotify had somehow managed to hire them their very own on-demand personal DJ who spoke directly to them, even using their name, in between hand-picking tracks based on their personal taste. The problem was that this grand illusion required a generative AI voice that was both instantaneous and indistinguishable from a real person. And this was a few years ago, so the technology simply didn't exist yet. So we had a great product, in theory. Most product people know that ideas are easy, but timing is hard. Almost everything works at some point. Look at pets.com. In the early aughts, pets.com was the biggest dot-com bubble disaster ever. Less than 20 years later, a company with the exact same business model sold for nearly $3.4 billion. We had to ask ourselves, is AI DJ a good idea right now? And the answer was actually no. It wasn't a good idea to launch it back then. With the existing technology at the time, it would have flopped. So the question became, is it worth it to build this product now, before it actually works, when we have no way of knowing exactly when the technology will be ready? Maybe it won't be a good idea for another year, or 2 years, or 10. So we looked at the trend lines for generative AI and voice, and we decided to gamble. The clock started ticking, and Ziad got to work. While we waited for the technology to, hopefully, mature, the next step was figuring out what this AI DJ would actually say when it introduced itself. The personalization team loves quantitative A-B testing across large populations, incrementally deploying them across different markets and user groups, and then collecting and analyzing incredibly detailed statistical findings on precisely what worked and what didn't. But the type of user testing Ziad wanted to do this time was different.
We kind of flipped it around and we said it's not going to be about designing amazing tests that might take a few weeks. It's going to be about testing with new users whatever we happen to have that is new every week.
Ziad pushed the team to dog food AI DJ, putting it through the paces with relentless weekly tests. He insisted that it would all be worth it, even if it wasn't always fun in the moment to see your convictions come crashing down when they meet reality.
For a long time, I was working in startups and a friend of mine used to give demos to each other all the time. And we used to give pretty critical feedback to each other. And we realized over the course of years together that it all always boils down to the user looking at your demo and saying, I'm confused and I don't care. Because as soon as the user says, I'm confused and I don't care, you immediately know what you're supposed to do. Oh, the button should be bigger, the script should be clearer, the thing. Like, as soon as it happens, you know exactly what is your next step. So rather than wait for it to happen, just assume that's the case and do it as fast as you can, as often as you can.
With this testing regimen, in order to succeed, the demo didn't need to be perfect or even polished. It just needed to be different enough from last week's test that we got new information about what we were getting wrong.
If you're willing to just go that fast and set the bar that high and say, like, we're not going to go to market if half of the people don't get it, then you just say every week, what are we going to change to make those tests go better? And every week, sure enough, we had changes to the script, changes to the voice, changes to the segments, changes to the button, to the UI, to the design. And every week, the team would get together. We would look at the insights that came out of that and say, this is what we learned here. This is what's working. This is what isn't. And that was a super, super valuable tool to move fast on developing the AI DJ.
And there's another reason that low-stakes testing is so important.
When you know it's coming every week, you're less scared to try a bunch of different things.
Testing so frequently and expecting people to start from a place of, I'm confused and I don't care, lower the stakes. The team pretty quickly got over trying to rigorously measure every single result. One of the earliest questions we wrestled with in user testing was, should the AI DJ say it's an AI? Our initial instinct was no. Users wouldn't care that we had made some flashy new technology. They might even be turned off by it. Luckily, as Ziad likes to put it, we weren't playing blackjack.
So in blackjack, you try to get to as close to 21 as you can, but if you get to 22, you lose the entire game. It's very important to know if you're in that situation, because if what you need to do is get as close to 21 as you can, but you don't die if you get to 22, then you should just go really hard. And if you're going to lose the whole thing with a very small error, then you should be very conservative. And very often, people don't make the distinction, right? And so they end up negotiating against themselves, even though it would be fine to overdo it by a little bit. So then what I often say is just dial it to 11. And it's the example of the AI DJ where we said, just state that it's an AI. Have the DJ say it's an AI, because the worst case scenario, we're not going to die. Like, it's not going to break the whole product. We'll just figure out what happens.
And guess what? When the AI DJ started telling people it was an AI, they went from, I'm confused and I don't care, to, whoa, that's really cool. You made this just for me? Listen, we all care about doing good work, and we all want to make inspiring products that get gold stars. So the instinct is often to stay in your garage and perfect the thing before the world gets to see it. But user feedback is not dangerous. Nothing truly terrible is going to happen if you try something out and it doesn't land. And if it feels like something terrible is going to happen, then maybe you aren't running the right kind of low-stakes test. Because the bigger risk is actually that you're negotiating against yourself without even realizing it. We also needed to decide how much to anthropomorphize the AI DJ. Should it use the first person? Is it more of a tool or a companion? Does it explain the mechanics of what's going on under the hood? Or instead just take credit for what you're about to hear? For example, in the early demos, the AI DJ would tell you exactly what was coming. Things like, up next, you'll hear tracks from one of your favorite playlists, Sunday Funday. They sounded something like this. You can hear how much better the listening experience has gotten.
As always, I've got a great lineup of music picked out for you. We're going to kick things off today with some music from one of your own playlists, Hot August Nights.
And then the users would say, I love this product, but the voice is in the way of the playlist that it's about to play.
It was kind of neat to hear an AI voice say the name of your playlist, but it wasn't really useful, and it certainly wasn't magic. If you wanted to listen to Sunday Funday, you could just put on Sunday Funday yourself. So the product's entire value proposition was getting lost. But instead of scrapping AI DJ, they dialed it to 11.
And so what we realized was the best relationship you could have with the DJ is not for the DJ to overly explain that, you know, it's going to play from your Discover Weekly or whatever, but it's going to take credit for the work that Spotify does on your behalf. And so then we changed the script. We said, anthropomorphize it, say I, take credit for the selection that we've been doing and so on. And then sure enough, we were only 1 week away from another user test. And then users started building this relationship with the DJ that made them more willing to listen to the selection, to try new things, to listen to the context the DJ is giving. So they went from, oh, the music is already there, this is just a voice on top, to I trust this DJ built just for me and I'm going to explore new songs. So sometimes you know too much, and when you step back a little bit, you're able to package your product in a way that is way better for the user.
And the thing that really surprised us? Once we dial it in and let the AI DJ take credit for curating the music, people listened to entire songs that they wouldn't have even clicked on if the track had simply shown up as a suggestion on the user's homepage in the app. In other words, if AI DJ played that exact same song with just a little bit of context, people suddenly enjoyed something they wouldn't have otherwise.
It is very much because when your mind imagines that song from 2 years ago, it can only get, you know, so excited about it. But when your ears hear that song from 2 years ago, it was your favorite for a reason, right? And so there is something about matching the medium of music with the audio recommendations that was doing something that our visual recommendations couldn't do.
We had unlocked a powerful new way to connect with listeners. Instead of only showing the user playlists with playlist name, image, and a long list of tracks, asking the user to imagine the mood and how they would feel if they listened to it, we could now actually set the context with the help of a human voice, start playing the music, and let users experience the mood. We now finally understood one of the things that people loved about the radio, and we were getting closer than ever to that perfect listening session. Remember that giant bet we made? That if Ziad and his team kept refining the product experience, the voice technology would get where it needed to be just in time for us to launch. It was time to see if we were right. Back then, and still today, most AI voice technology relied on diffusion models with billions of parameters. This means that they're very expensive per minute of audio they generate, and also very slow. It took about 10 minutes to generate a single minute of synthetic voice. As we theoretically might need to generate, say, at least 2 minutes of audio per day for our 500 million users, that could mean over a billion minutes per day. There was simply no way we could pull off AI DJ using those models. So we had to keep searching. And then we came across Sonantic.
Hi there. I'm not really sure how to start this. I wanted to talk to you about something. Something we're all looking for.
Sonantic's co-founders, Sina Qureshi and John Flynn, took a different approach.
What you're hearing me say was never said by a human. It was generated by a computer. I'm not real.
While the large and expensive diffusion models were trained on a huge number of different voices, with the objective of being able to generate any voice for a long amount of time, Sonantic did the opposite. They trained a small model on lots of data from a single voice, with the objective of being able to generate that single voice for a short amount of time. This is exactly what the DJ needed, and it made all the difference. Because the model was much smaller, it was both faster and cheaper for our use case. This process is often called overfitting to a single dataset. The easiest way to explain it is If you have two models and you train one model with thousands of pictures of different cats, it will get really good at saying whether or not a picture is a picture of a general cat versus, say, a goat or a dog. If you train the other model with thousands of pictures of your own cat, it will be able to say with certainty whether or not a photo of any given cat is specifically your cat. So Nantic was not only capable of generating the voice, they had even invented what they call an emotional markup language that lets you direct the voice using phrases like, "sound more excited." We were blown away. The technology piece was very nearly there, right on schedule. One of my favorite product strategy lessons here is that, especially in fast-moving fields, if you want to be early, you actually can't wait for a technology to start working and then build a product based on it. You have to intercept the future by starting long before it actually works. So in 2022, we acquired Sonantic. With the decision to overfit to a single voice, immediately came the question, how do you cast the first ever voice of Spotify? From the beginning, we already knew whose voice had all the traits we would want to overfit a model to. Xavier Jernigan, better known as X. These days, X is Spotify's head of cultural partnerships. He's a music industry veteran who worked in marketing for Universal, Sony, and Def Jam before joining Spotify in 2016, and has hosted multiple Spotify podcasts like Showstopper and The Get Up.
Hey, I'm Xavier Jernigan, and you're listening to The Get Up, Spotify's daily morning show. Every weekday morning, me and my co-host Kat Lasso talk news, pop culture, sports, and the biggest trending stories of the day. It's New Music Friday, so we're going to get into our top picks of the week in just a minute. But first, the Kardashians dropped their new show on Hulu yesterday.
You might recognize that voice from the top of the episode. That's right. The whole time we were trying to create a synthetic voice during our user tests, we kept saying it has to sound more like X. With the decision to overfit to a real person's voice, we realized, why not X?
Especially coming from the record label side, I always knew when I heard a hit. And I knew this was a hit.
So Ziad gave him the pitch.
The way he described it to me, I was so fired up. Now, he showed me nothing. So this is all just him saying it. I didn't see a deck, a slide, a diagram, nothing. No, I didn't hear any examples, which I think was good. And I had a couple of questions, but then I just went for it. And within maybe 5-6 days, we were actually making the voice of AIX, the voice model of AIX.
The process of actually making the voice of AIX was a grind. In order to have such a short inference period, Sonantic's technology instead had a very long initial training period, requiring hundreds of hours of high-quality recordings as the dataset for its voice model. So X started going into the studio every day, joined by an expert team of directors, engineers, and scriptwriters, both remotely and in person. And the audio had to be pristine.
All the conditions had to be perfect. I mean, you can't hear the wire on a microphone hit my shirt. If it grazes my shirt, we have to stop and do that line again. We have our engineers. They're listening for any sound other than my voice.
We quickly realized that if we wanted AI DJ to sound like X, and we did, that meant taking X's notes on the script and adjusting the wording so it was more authentic to his voice. Beyond anthropomorphizing the AI DJ, we were adding a layer of humanity to it.
And when we do that and personalize it, it was a huge step change. And it's that secret sauce that we have. It's so subtle, but it's so key. And it makes all the difference. When I was in the booth, when we were recording, you know, training the voice model, we recorded and trained the voice model in different ways. It made a difference. And it felt more like me as a performer, as the person that it's based on, to say it that way, because that's how I would recommend music for you. Me, Xavier, X. And it was like there was no separation in a performance between what the real X does and how I suggest music and what you hear with AI DJ.
What we really wanted to do and managed to do was to actually digitize the personality.
Right.
And it's a very different thing to sort of capture the personality. Right, it doesn't feel like a voice. I think that's the wrong way to think about it.
I totally agree. I think what really turned it from a voice to a personality as well, something as simple as saying my name. And that was something that was important to me from an introduction and connection standpoint.
Although we had settled many questions about what the AI DJ should say and how it should sound, there was still a debate on the product team about whether or not the AI DJ should introduce itself by name. And if so, what name should that be? At the same time, we kept on user testing demos, now voiced by X. And the testers didn't know X personally, so they assumed the voice they were hearing was synthetic, not a real person's. And it raised some tough but necessary questions.
I'm a black man. I'm an African American. And, you know, our voices sound different. So without seeing me, most people, pretty much everybody, can tell I'm a black American, right? So there are implications for that, how people felt about when they heard it without the full context and without fully understanding that the voice that you're hearing is a real human being. The name that you hear, everything that it's based on is just a digitized version of me. Without knowing that, some things we saw in research, and this is the other part about why it's so important that I say my name. Without saying my name and just hearing the voice, questions came up like this. Am I getting this voice because I'm black? Is this a black version of a voice that I'm getting? Are you serving this because I'm black? Wait, is Spotify trying to make Spotify sound like a black person? So, you know, there's a term called digital blackface. So there are things like that, that people raise these concerns. And they, without the full context, you don't know. And, you know, people are very wary of companies misappropriating these things. You know, appropriation is a real concern that people have, and rightfully so. I get it. So I think that was a big part of why it was important for AI DJ to introduce himself, for me to say, hey, I'm Xavier. And it's exactly how I say it to people. So everything you hear is based on what I really say. But things like that alleviated the concerns. So before I said my name, those concerns were raised in terms of the research. And we really addressed it head on. It's something we talked about head on. Like, these are concerns that are coming up, and we talked about it. And I remember raising my hand and I said, I think the best way to solve this concern is to tell them who I am. When it just said, hey, this moment on, I'm your AI DJ on Spotify. People said, hey, whoa, I don't know. Like, the voice sounds cool, but did y'all make a voice sound black? As opposed to, is this a real person, right? But then when it said, hey, I'm Xavier, my friends call me X, and from this moment on, I'm your own personal AI DJ on Spotify, then it turns into, oh, that's cool. And you stop thinking about it, because once you know it's a real person.
This is a great host.
That's right.
This is a great DJ. That's why.
And then it all went away. And I think because we had the tough conversations internally and said what needed to be said and figured it out, we got to the right place of doing it.
This was a blind spot to us that we would never have caught without user testing. Because we already knew X, of course we knew why X sounded like X. But if you don't know X, the reasonable assumption is actually that the voice is personalized to you, like those diffusion models we talked about. Once people understood who X is and that he's a real person, it was as obvious to them as it was to us why he was the best choice to be the first voice of AI DJ. Under any circumstances, putting yourself in a position to receive honest feedback, even if it's ultimately positive feedback, can be uncomfortable. X actually started attending some of the user tests himself to see how people were responding to his voice. At the end of the user testing session, he'd reveal himself.
I would turn my camera on, unmute, and say, hey, I'm X. I'm the voice you just heard. And they would all freak out. Like, oh, wait, so you are a real person. And when we saw that moment, that's when we knew we had magic.
Along with being a new magic trick, this was also a new precedent for us. We all agreed that this was way beyond the scope of X's standard employment agreement and beyond the scope of any talent deal we'd ever done or even heard of before, with entirely new factors to take into account.
The truth is, with success, my voice would be heard more than the biggest podcasters in the world. How do I get rewarded for success? What does success look like? Iterations of the product. What does that look like? So all of those kinds of considerations had to be thought about, had to be hashed out, and had to be put on paper in a way that was fair on both sides and competitive, and where I could be rewarded for success of this.
This was like one of the first likeness deals.
Literally.
That we had to figure out, like, how is this supposed to work
at
all,
right.
actually?
That's right. And that's what's in there, literally, name, image, likeness. Like, that's in there. We made considerations for that.
You might be familiar with the term NIL deal, meaning name, image, and likeness deal, because it's all over the news today. But back then, this type of agreement wasn't in the public vocabulary the way it is now. So there were no templates to work off of. And X discovered that one of the downsides to being the first is that sometimes it feels a little lonely.
And I'm proud of the deal that we got to, and I feel very good about where we landed and confident. But, you know, when it's like, you know, when you're at a company you love, and I've, you know, been fortunate enough to have a lot of success here as an executive and from the talent side, you know, to your point, this is a whole nother level. When you're negotiating, the truth is you're on one side of the table and the company is on another side. We knew we were going to get to a good place, but it just felt, part of it felt a little lonely, you know, to a degree, because no one else has ever done this ever, you know? But I feel like we did it the right way on both sides, and I feel really good.
X felt good. We felt good. The unprecedented NIL deal, however tricky, meant that X was officially the voice of AI DJ. But X's voice, as important as it is still only one aspect of how you interact with AI DJ. Around the same time that Ziad approached X about voicing AI DJ, Emily Galloway was brought in to oversee the holistic UX and ultimate launch of AI DJ.
Ultimately, my team, we don't just play with pixels. We play with pixels and decibels because we're designing experiences that you look at and that you listen to.
Emily's background is in design, but for this project, she was brought in as the executive sponsor, her first time in that role. She likes to say that she was the oil in the glue for AI DJ, meaning that she got things unstuck and she held everything together, depending on what her team needed from her at any given time. And Emily leads with intention, like a couple of clever, seemingly small tactical changes that Emily made when she came on board.
When I stepped in, I think there was maybe one Slack channel with over 40 people in it. And I'm thinking, oof, like it's really hard to be safe in a channel of that many people. So we kicked off a smaller leads team. And within that team, maybe there were 10 or 11 of us. And another small, subtle decision I made, we didn't call ourselves DJ Leads. I named the group Leading to Launch because every day I wanted to remind them, we are the group leading this product to launch. And that was a very important mindset that when I stepped in, I think the question was, what are we launching? We didn't quite know. And that was okay. But this group of leads, our job was to figure that out together.
And Emily knew that figuring it out together was going to be especially daunting in this scenario. Because with AI DJ, we weren't just improving an existing product.
In personalization, we do typically iterate on things, or we get it out there and we're doing A-B tests with actual listeners. And when it's 0 to 1, you do have to take a little more risk. You know, I think maybe one of my roles as sponsor was to get people to stay focused on the possibility and the potential, and worry a little bit less about the risk and the unknown, because we did have to take a leap of faith. And this was a really hard project. We've never done anything like it before. So it was a project where I felt I parachuted in and I truly was on the ground with the troops every single day. And it is needed sometimes as a leader. Sometimes you can stay high level, but there are times you need to be on the ground and do things with your team, through your team.
Emily's team had leads from product, design, engineering, PR, marketing, editorial teams, and music. And Emily recognized that in a situation like this, where you have people from all over the company who may have never worked together before, and everyone is outside of their comfort zone, the key would be open and honest communication. A lot of leaders understand the value of open and honest communication, and I think most do their best to facilitate it. But it's a lot harder than it sounds. By being on the ground, Emily made sure she was creating an environment where people could speak up and express their instincts, even if they weren't popular opinions, or they couldn't quite figure out why they felt a certain way.
People weren't afraid to be the one person in the room who disagreed or who just had a gut feeling or wanted to raise something. People just weren't afraid to speak up. People felt comfortable saying, like, I don't understand this. I don't get this. And then the response would be, tell me more, because it's coming from someplace. And I reminded folks, too, if you're feeling something, like, at the end of the day, what is gut? What is instinct? It's not like this fleeting feeling. Like, it's based off of previous experiences.
Which brings up that eternal struggle in product strategy. What are instincts? Who decides whose instincts are good and when to trust them? In other words, when should a gut check be your guiding light?
Here's one of my big mantras of life and leadership. If something doesn't make sense, it's probably because it actually doesn't make sense. So if something doesn't make sense, speak up.
I want to jump more into that, actually. You want people with good instincts, but at the same time, the whole point of user research and testing and design, really, is that most people don't have great instincts. Because if they did, everyone, you know, wouldn't need to do user research. How do you think about this? How do you think about trusting instincts versus not trusting instincts?
I will say, when you're innovating, it does make everyone uncomfortable. It's unknown territory. And I do think there's a balance to it. So it can't be 100% instinct, and it also can't be 100% insights. We definitely learned things in user research. But if we relied on user research only, I don't think we actually would have ever announced this was an AI.
This is where SEAD's low-stakes user testing comes into the picture. If people feel safe to voice their differing opinions, and you're testing often enough that you can afford to experiment, you maximize the value of your user research. Like when we decided to go against our collective instincts and try letting AI DJ say it's an AI.
We didn't user research our way into the intro where the voice says, hey, I'm an AI. That came from someone having instincts saying, it feels weird we're not acknowledging this. And someone kept pushing on this gut feeling. Then we chose to test that gut feeling. And when we tested that gut feeling and did it, we were like, wow, this landed better. It's not like we tested it and users said, hey, you're misleading me. You didn't tell me it was an AI. No one said that, but someone just felt there was an opportunity and the instinct let us explore it.
And that's lesson number 3. It's not trust your gut. It's test your gut. Yes, as a leader, you need to find and recruit people with better than average instincts. That's super important. But everybody's instincts are wrong at least some of the time. So the way to do it is to listen to those instincts, but quickly let them meet reality by user testing them. Instead of letting the user testing sort of randomly guide you into things without understanding why you actually do them, which is the risk with pure data-driven development. It was in this environment that Emily's team applied design thinking to the first time you meet AI DJ.
We invested a lot in the character of DJ, and we really established this trust and relationship. So we often called this the unboxing process. But in those first 20 seconds, when you first listen to DJ, how do we do this in a way that you are going to trust the voice or maybe even laugh and be delighted by the voice?
Part of this trust was established explicitly in the things AI DJ actually says, like explaining that it's an AI, and then introducing itself by name. Other aspects are more subtle. For example, we've seen that, in general, when it comes to music discovery, if we lead with something familiar, a song that people already know and love, they'll be more open to recommendations for new music. With that in mind, and through tons of user testing, Emily's team decided that when you open up AI DJ for the first time, it wouldn't just address you by name, it would also play snippets of your favorite music and mention genres you listen to often. Or through AI DJ's visual design.
So when I stepped in, it was still very technical feeling. And I would say it was much more cold and stark. Very black, green, sound waves. Felt a bit more like an assistant. It was really yet to be human. But I will say, I remember a conversation with Ziad who said, you know, this is more Star Trek than Star Wars or the reverse. I think I actually Googled these terms to be like, wait, which is Star Wars? Which is Star Trek? But I quickly got the gist. This is too cold. We need it friendlier. And I do remember that moment in the project where we had a design critique and we were really owning this actually is way too technical, cold feeling, and we need to make this much more human.
But we didn't take the obvious approach to making AI DJ feel more familiar and human. Instead of using more concrete or figurative imagery, we went in the opposite direction and chose to abstract it, ending up with AI DJ's elegant, playful circle design.
I will say from a design lens, we also love that it is a bit ambiguous and mysterious. Typically, we rely on artist imagery or we show a track list of what's coming. With DJ, we have kept it much more mysterious because it's really choosing to trust in this adventure. And you really are letting the DJ choose for you. But really also, amazing magical thing the DJ does is it adds context and it tells you why it chose what it chose. Never before on Spotify have we given you context of recommendations with decibels. We put context in your ears.
This is another important aspect of the AI DJ content experience. AI DJ's programming is generated by AI, but it is also informed by the same editors and tastemakers we tapped for Algotorial. They're music experts who know what's happening in the broader music world, and they can infuse the AI's programming with that extra context. Like when it's the 50th anniversary of hip-hop and you're a hip-hop fan, AI DJ will let you know. The voice, the visuals, the technology, and the programming were all coming together in the run-up to the launch. Everyone was working as hard as they possibly could to meet this deadline that was years in the making. And then came the battle over the URIs. Stay with me, because we're about to get techie. URI stands for Uniform Resource Identifier. Each URI is a unique sequence of characters that enables Spotify's system to deliver content across different surfaces and Spotify's machine learning systems to know what kind of content it is. Every song, podcast episode, or audiobook has a URI. It's how the app knows which piece of content to call so it appears on the home screen or in your library. The debate was, how should AI DJ's URI fit into the backend? Now, this sounds like a small thing, but the decision would have massive implications for Spotify's entire architecture. We didn't exactly build Spotify with AI DJ in mind. Emily's team was planning to launch with a custom URI because the AI DJ was something new and different. But some people wanted to use Spotify's standard playlist URI.
It was brought up because there's another team that's much more accountable for making sure what we're doing fits into our broader systems and that we are going to be able to distribute this across all of our devices. And the way we had built it made that really hard. It was possible, but it was really hard. I do remember hopping on a call with the technical lead in the other team just to understand this. And we realized there's still a little bit more we had to know, so we made a decision to do something called a tech spike. They were going to take 2 weeks to really explore a proof of concept, but even agreeing to do the tech spike was going to delay the launch by 2 weeks.
On the one hand, AI DJ had been a North Star for years, so what's another 2 weeks? On the other hand, AI DJ had been a North Star for years. Shouldn't we just get it out there and figure it out later? Emily made the call.
Sometimes you just have to do the right thing. And this felt like, you know what? We're one Spotify. We need to figure this out with our partners. Doing a tech spike together would at least help us land the decision in unison. And that was really important.
Through the spike, we realized it would be a long-term mistake to rush ahead without thoughtfully restructuring our URIs, even if it meant delaying the launch further. Getting to market as quickly as possible with a few loose ends might have worked in the past or for startups. But today, Spotify is a big company. Our users expect mature products on day one.
So we did decide to push back the launch, but to do it in a way that fit into our ecosystem of systems much better.
Finally, we set a date for the press event in New York City, February 21st, 2023. Everyone is invited. Emily, Ziad, X, even X's mom is there.
And she's having the time of her life. The team treated her so great, and they're just loving on her, and they're just so happy to meet her. And she gets to see it and understand it, because she understands when I do podcasts, right? Because she could just listen to that.
She's not deep into generative AI.
Right, exactly. And so the fact that she got to be here and see the presentations and see how it all comes together was really special. And the team, they always ask about her now, too, which I love.
And then the next day, AI DJ officially launches. X's closest friends and family start using it, and that's when he gets the best user test of them all.
And when they started using it and their feedback started rolling in, I was like, man, we got something. Well, my boy Kenny from back home, who's known me since fifth grade, Gustav, he said, yo, man, it sounds like you're riding with me in the car right now while I'm playing my music, like we're riding around the city. When he said that, I was like, oh, we got him. Because my own thing was, I just got to sound like me. I need to sound like, if I sound like me, if Kenny thinks I sound like me, we got him.
Within a few weeks, we knew that X's initial take on AI DJ was spot on. It was a hit. Posts on social media poured in. Memes started going viral. And people said things like,
I wish I could marry my AI DJ. Embarrassing, but good. That means I'm doing it right. This is so cute.
As one person even posted,
Spotify's AI DJ knows me better than I know myself.
I mean, that's literally what you want to read if you're working in personalization.
That's right.
And machine learning.
That's right. Feel like the Spotify AI DJ is my new best friend. It takes music discovery to a whole new level. Always nice to fall in love with the product again. That's it. It just warms my heart. And it makes me smile because that means we're doing it right. This is what it's all about. It's real connection.
And what's more, the data bears this out. I asked X why he thinks that's happening.
I think it's this association where, wait a minute, this person is with me all the time. They get me. And there's no judgment. That's the thing, too. It's like, this is your music. And your music is okay because you're okay. And I think there's a lot of value that people see in that. I think a feeling of belonging that people feel with that because I'm everybody's DJ. And at the masses, I'm your DJ. And that's what's so powerful. It's like, I know you. And I like the fact that we use phrases that I really say, like, okay, I got you. Okay, changing it up. Like, I like the fact that we do that. We're acknowledging them. We're saying, I got you. Let's try something else. And then when it lands on that thing, it's just this special, magical moment happens for them.
We set out to pick apart what was so great about radio, capture it, and remove the rest. But in the process, we also ended up improving a bunch of things. AI DJ offers a whole new level of intimacy for our users, and a new way to interact with and be guided through the treasure trove that is the world's music catalog. Far beyond what terrestrial radio offer. Plus, unlike radio, you can skip songs, switch the vibe, and you don't have to listen to ads. And because of personalization, you can trust that no matter what your taste in music is, AI DJ will have your back, playing throwbacks, new discoveries, and a few surprises along the way. Before we go, here's a recap of today's lessons. Lesson number one. Products are an average of their parts, not a sum. Adding more features that are okay, but not as good as the best one, will always pull down the average. Whereas removing a feature that is just okay will raise the average. Lesson number two. Understand new technologies before they mature. Extrapolate when they will be mature and intercept the future. Lesson number three. Don't trust your gut. Test your gut. Have convictions, but let them crash into reality early and often. And that's a wrap on today's episode. We want to hear from you. Let us know in the comments, what Spotify products are you most curious about? And which lessons have been the most helpful so far? Spotify, a product story, is produced by Arcana Audio for Spotify. Our executive producer is Francis Harlow. We're edited by Francis Harlow, produced by Samira Tazari, and mixed and sound designed by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Andrea Fantuzzi. Special thank you to the Spotify users who share their posts with us. You know who you are. And to Veronica Hart, Spotify's Global Head of Communications for Product and Technology. We couldn't have made this show without you. I'm Gustav Söderström. Thanks for listening.